Oral history interview with Dr. Bill Little on the 5th of January 2007. Arthur Demrich and Arnold Thackeray are the interviewers. Bill, tell us a bit about where you were born and your early childhood.
Well, I was born in Hickory, North Carolina, which is in the western part of the state, into a family that was ultimately 9 children. There were 2 sets, actually. My father outlived 2 wives, married a third time, but the children were all by the first 2 marriages. The first one was 5 children, the second one was 4, but we grew up as a big family spanning a number of years. My father was in academia in the early part of his life. He taught at Lenore Ryan College, and he held a position that today would be called provost. And his interest was history. He taught Latin, Greek, French, German, Hebrew, and weather. So he kind of was a jack of all trades, specializing in languages and history, which incidentally had a big collection of early history books, books written around the turn of the century. And it's fair, I still have many of those books. It's a lot of fun to read those because the way history was presented is so different from what it is today. And it history reeked of prejudices, as you might imagine. But it is a lot of fun to read those books. And even though they're kind of dull, they're a quick way to get a perspective. What are you talking about? French history, the French Revolution, and its aftermath, or whether you're talking about early British history. But anyhow, he was in academia, but when the family reached 7 or 8 kids, it was kind of hard to subsist on a faculty member salary, so he went into the savings and loan business, where he was became CEO of a savings and loan and was a very successful businessman in that activity.
What was the name of those savings and loan?
It was, initially, it was Mutual Building and Loan Association, but later, First Fidelity Federal Savings and Loan. So, I grew up in a small town, and it was really fun. And one of the things that you could realize in those days, something I don't think exists to the same extent today, is how you would fall in love with your teachers in public schools. They were so dedicated. And in particular, my math teachers and my English teachers were just unparalleled. Had a big influence on me that I still think about today. Of course, in those days, and there were depression or post-depression years, schools didn't have much in the way of science except for biology. And I had some good biology program teaching, but no chemistry, no physics. They just weren't taught because they didn't have the personnel. So I didn't have so much of an interest in chemistry in my public school days. That came later when I went to college. And there I went to a local church-related liberal arts college called Lenore Ryan College. And actually, our home was practically on the campus, so I was not a typical day student. I was almost a residential student, except I didn't go to a dormitory at night. Although my mother died just about the time I started, and there were 3 of us boys, so in a sense, maybe it was a dormitory. But at any rate, my interest in, I was originally pre-med in college, and I remember interviewing at Duke University as a potential medical student, and I was it was after 3 years of college with the idea that they had a program where you could begin medical school and finish the 4th year of a baccalaureate degree in the process. And I was applying to get into that. And that interview is what brought to the forefront of my mind that I really didn't want to go into medicine, that I wanted to go into chemistry or science. I thought maybe math, but either math or chemistry.
So what happened during the interview that brought you?
I'll tell you something. You may not want to put this in it. Sat there with three people, and one of the medical doctors pulled out a pack of cigarettes and said, "Have a cigarette. We eat your cabbage, so you ought to be using our products." Of course, he was off base because cabbages were grown up in the mountains, not in the foothills. But I knew where the tobacco was right. I took his cigarette, and we conducted the interview. That's not what turned me off. I just went on the way home. I said, you know, this is not what I want to do. Chemistry kind of runs in my family in a sense. I have an older brother who, during the Depression, got as far as a master's degree at North Carolina State University, then went to work for Hercules Powder Company, it was called then, and during the war worked on some projects like soaps that would form suds in salt water. You know, the troops at Guadalcanal needed to take a bath.
Yeah.
And you know what happens with ordinary soap when you put it in salt water. It just becomes a rock.
Yeah.
So he worked on projects like that, and I was always very close to him. I have a sister who majored in chemistry, and she taught chemistry in the public schools in Greenville, South Carolina. I have a nephew who worked for Glaxo, which illustrates an important about the research triangle. Here's his nephew from Hickory, North Carolina, who otherwise would have to have left the state after he got his PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But he was able to stay right here and work for Glaxo. He still is with Glaxo. And then another nephew who works for Merck in Philadelphia, or out of Philadelphia, I've forgotten the community. He got a PhD in our chemistry department. He got his bachelor's degree in our chemistry department. He won the Venable Medal, which is the outstanding award for a senior. And we got through all that without any of my colleagues knowing we were related, which was important. Then he went on to Harvard and worked with and then went to work for Merck,
mm-hmm.
where he's a group leader of some sort. So there is a fair amount of chemistry in my family.
You just said your brother got a master's at NC State. In that day, what was the differentiation of UNC and NC State? I mean, why?
Well, I really ought to clarify that. He got his master's degree in chemical engineering. And there is no engineering at Chapel Hill.
Okay.
And at that time, there probably was not a master's in chemistry, just a baccalaureate. It was in the ag school. But then later, they got their master's degree and the PhD. So I did, I should have said chemical engineering. But as far as I was concerned, he was a chemist.
What did the other family, what do your other siblings go on to do?
Well, let's see, my oldest brother was in the retail business for most of his life and then later became responsible for the building and grounds at a Lutheran Theological Seminary in Columbia, South Carolina. My oldest sister taught public schools, as did my second oldest sister, and my remaining sister. They all taught in public school. Another older brother worked for a newspaper in North Augusta, South Carolina, which is near the Savannah River plant. And then comes my third sister who taught school, and then my first younger brother worked in the savings and loan that my father ran, and then my youngest brother taught mathematics in Tallahassee. So as a family, kind of rooted in education, mm-hmm. both public schools and otherwise.
But you were easily the most academic.
Yes, yeah. I went the farthest in terms of formal education.
What was the, in Hickory when you growing up, what was the racial and ethnic mixture of the town?
I would say that the community was probably 20 to 25% black. It was totally segregated. The school systems were separate. Water fountains were separate. The waiting rooms at the train station were separate. It was a typical southern segregated community. Yet, many of the personal relationships between whites and blacks were very, very close and cordial on an individual basis. But on a group basis, prejudice was rife.
Sounds like Philadelphia today.
You know, I think you've got a point, and I think that you would find that in most of the communities in the South, integration has gone far further than it has in the rest of the country. I don't really perceive any problems in North Carolina in the public schools. Now, you're going to have incidents, but it's going to be sometimes between white and white, black and black, not just white and black. And you're going to have ruffians on the streets at night sometimes, but it's not, you know, racially characteristic. Embraces both races. I think a tremendous amount of progress has been made. When I first came to the university, it was segregated, and as a graduate student, and then in about my second year, the integration of the university began, and it was slow at first, but today, I think that probably it's as far more integrated than the university in the Northeast. It's far more so than Stanford, for example. And there are no real problems. Incidents will occur that will cause people to, some people to take positions based on ethnic lines. If you had a major national, well, you take the recent lacrosse episode at Duke University. That caused a great deal of division among students and others based on race. But if there hadn't been a racial element in that lacrosse case, you wouldn't have seen it. So I'm very optimistic about what's happened in the Southeast, and at least the part of the Southeast that I know. I feel very, very good. We have good some real leadership from the black community and the Research Triangle Foundation. One of the most important institutions that seldom gets mentioned when you talk about the Research Triangle economic development is our North Carolina Community College and Technical Institute program. We've got 58 such institutions scattered across North Carolina, and they are training people that previously were making furniture or hosiery or spinning cotton threads are now working in the electronics energy industry, the biotechnology industry, and technically based industries, because these community colleges can retrain those workers to do that. And over in Durham Community and Technical College, I believe it is. Durham Technical Community College.
Okay.
The president of that institution, Fayal Wynn, is somebody I work with regularly on the board of the Triangle Foundation and the Triangle Institute. And to my mind, he's absolutely the top person on both of those boards in terms of the ability to analyze, recognize, articulate. We've just done very well in making one community out of this. And this Technical Institute is just first class. And I should mention that when Luther Hodges was governor and started this Research Triangle program, which we'll talk about later, one of the things he did is said, look, if we're going to change the profile of opportunity in North Carolina, we've got to retrain our workers. And he started the Technical Institutes program with an institution up in Lincoln County, which is just short of the mountains. And that has grown into the, as I say, the second largest system in the country, of some 58. There's one technical institute within 15 miles of every resident of the state. Mm-hmm. So that's a powerful thing when you are interested in recruiting industry or starting up industry, or whether you're talking about healthcare, or whether you're talking about English as a second language, or Spanish as a second language. These technical institutes are doing a fantastic job. And it's part and parcel of what Luther Hodges visualized in the Research Triangle program. I mean, he didn't visualize the language problem so much, because that came later, right, as you well know. But the institutes were there. Mm-hmm. And it's important both of training our own people to handle Spanish or the Latinos to deal with English.
Let me take you back to the chemistry study, though, in your undergrad days. So can you remember some of the main mentors? Did you get in the lab and do a bit of actual research as an undergrad?
In those days, no. Mm-hmm. We had one chemistry professor for a four-year program. Mm-hmm. And the facilities were not adequate in those days. I first encountered research as part of the undergraduate curriculum when I taught at Reed College in 1955. Sixty Reed is in Portland, Oregon, and it's an outstanding, outstanding institution. So my college chemistry was not all that great. I had two professors that were particularly inspiring. One was a math professor who really taught me precision. I mean, you know, when you did a mathematics problem, you punctuated. Colons, semicolons, commas, periods. And he was a real stickler, but it was the best training I ever had. And then when I came down here, Chapel Hill, I came originally as a math graduate student. Okay. And took differential equations that was a summer course, under the toughest math professor in the course. And I had all these people that had been at Chapel Hill for a while telling me, look, I know you come from a small school, and Bert Linker is a tough, tough professor. Don't expect anything more than a C. Well, hell, I made an A. So I felt very good about the background this professor built in me. And the other was a history professor. I didn't care for his subject so much at that time, but he gave me two words that it took me a while to assimilate, but I wouldn't trade anything for those two words, and those two words are intellectual curiosity. So that's worth more than any history that I learned from this professor, because it was a concept that it took me a while to fully appreciate, and now I really treasure what little bit I have that I think consciously, to some degree, has emanated from his use of that term, intellectual curiosity. Great term.
What made you decide you were going to go to graduate school?
that interview for medical school.
You're going to get another qualification, I guess.
I definitely wanted higher qualifications. That was not the issue. I decided I didn't want to go into medicine. As a matter of fact, I had been a little bit of a phobia toward blood. I'd seen accidents that bothered me. And that, I had to think long and hard, do I really want to get into this? And I decided against it. But there's also the pull of mathematics and chemistry. I actually met the requirements of three majors in college: math, chemistry, and biology. And I enjoyed all three of them.
Mm-hmm. So
I didn't want to get away from the laboratory. That's what it amounts to.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I didn't know fully well what a laboratory is then, and then of course today, laboratories are so different.
Well, tell us about the transition then in grad school from math to chemistry. I mean, you said
I came to graduate school in the summer. Mm-hmm. And took a few courses in mathematics as a mathematics graduate student. And during that summer, I realized that I really did miss the laboratory. So I asked to transfer into chemistry. And my request was granted. So by the fall, I was a chemistry graduate student. So, and I felt like I was coming home. So,
Your father was paying for this initially?
Yes, initially, but only... Oh, that's an interesting story. My father always said, I'll buy you all the education you want. But when I came to graduate school in chemistry, I wound up getting a teaching assistantship. And he said, well, you know, I believe you can be on your own now. And I went on my own. But then the following spring, with the encouragement of one of my chemistry professors, I applied for one of these brand new Moorhead scholarships.
That's a state scholarship?
No. Uh-uh. John Motley Moorhead was a graduate of our chemistry department back in the 1890s. His father had a textile mill or cotton mill up in Spray, North Carolina, which is on the Virginia border. It built a dam to generate power. And this dam was generating far more power than the textile company needed. Moorhead, being fresh out of the university with a chemistry degree, knew quite well that you could not make aluminum by heating bauxite with carbon, the way you smelt iron. The electric furnace had just been developed in France, achieving temperatures far beyond what you could get with a regular furnace. And so he figured, hell, they just hadn't heated the bauxite hot enough.
Uh-huh.
So he stoked up his electric furnace with bauxite and carbon, but still didn't get anywhere. So he came down and asked Professor Venable, his old professor, said, you know, here's what I'm trying to do. And Venable said, well, why don't you throw some limestone in there? Maybe you can reduce the calcium, and then the calcium might reduce the aluminum. So he stoked up the furnace with a mix of bauxite and limestone, but all he got was a slag. Like material. And they had a slag heap over here, and there are various stories about how it got wet, whether it was rain or some other purpose or some other way. But at any rate, when it got wet, it would give off a gas that would burst into flame. You with me?
Yeah.
So this was the beginning of the discovery of calcium carbide. Well, he brought some of this slag down to the chemistry department. The Venable said, this gas catches on fire when it's wet. Venable had another student by the name of William Rand Keenan, Jr. the origin of the Keenan professorships. Okay. Billy Keenan was given this problem of identifying the gas. Well, he went to the lab, came back a little bit later, and said, that gas is acetylene. This was the beginning of Union Carbide Corporation.
Yeah.
So Moorhead got Union Carbide, he got the patent. Keenan got a job working for Moorhead. Later, he went to work for Rockefeller, Standard Oil, yeah. Mm-hmm. Had a successful career there, and then left Rockefeller and went to work for Henry Flagler, who developed the east coast of Florida and the Florida railroads.
Yeah.
And William Keenan was the engineer that engineered the railroads, and they would bring tourists down. Also, they set up these hotels, Coconut Grove or some of the others, well-known ones, and they'd bring tourists down from New York in the wintertime and carry oranges back on those railroads. And at the same time, they had the big hotel business. So that was a very successful venture with Henry Flagler. And the Flagler is a big name in Florida. You may have encountered that, I don't know. But later, what really happened is that Keenan's sister married Henry Flagler, outlived him, got his estate, then married the newspaper baron in Kentucky, Louisville, what was that name? Bingham, outlived him. So she had now accumulated two estates. Mary Lily Keenan Flagler Bingham, I think now. So that William Rand Keenan's biggest fortune came from his sister's estate, in reality. But it was still connected with the Carbide story. Well, now, how do we get off on all that? Well, the Moorhead Scholarship Program, well, Moorhead did, he loved the university. He had no children. And one, he was ambassador to Sweden under Herbert Hoover. And at that time was the single largest stockholder in Union Carbide. While he was in Sweden, somebody offered him a Zeiss planetarium cheap. He bought it, put it on storage, and then later in the mid-40s, gave it to the university and built a beautiful building around it, which is the entertainment center for special dinners, so on. And then later he established the Moorhead Scholarship Merit Scholarship Program, mm-hmm. which is one of the most lucrative scholarship programs in the country, based totally on merit, an elaborate interview system with subcommittees scattered across North Carolina and outside of North Carolina at selected prep schools, and then a final selection here in Chapel Hill, and they award about 50 to 60 full-paid four-year scholarships. And with a summer enrichment program where they might work in a police department one summer or a fire department, another summer they might work in business, another summer they might work in a government office. They have a lot of different options. Before the first year, they go to Outward Bound, you know, that program. So it's a beautiful program. Now, I was in the first class. This was in 1951, spring of 51. That was during the Korean conflict. And at that time, graduate students were getting exemptions and undergraduates were being drafted. And they wanted to get the program started before Moorhead died. So they started it on the graduate level. And there were eight of us in that first class. Well, that really saw me through graduate school.
So you must have been doing pretty well to be selected into that.
Yeah. Extremely lucky, I think, to have gotten that. And then later, I served for 20 years on the central selection committee and chaired it for about half that time. Served it. It's been a big part of my life. Mm-hmm. And I did get to know Mr. Moorhead, and he was quite a character. Very formal fellow. He spoke almost with an English accent. He had certainly cultured his speech. He was mayor of Rye, New York for a long time. But he really wanted a program that was patterned after the Rhodes Scholarship Program. And in those days, it was only men, and they couldn't be married, and all the same rules that the Rhodes Program had. Mm-hmm. But then over time, that changed, and it's gender neutral. And don't know about the marriage part, whether they can be married today or not. It used to be if they got married, they'd lose their scholarship. I don't know if that still exists. But anyhow, that was a great experience for me, and what it did, the greatest value of that was not the money, it was the obligation it created in me to live up to what that scholarship meant. And through my whole career, I've never forgotten that scholarship. And just pause so many times to say, now wait a minute, you were a Moorhead Scholar. Make the right decision. And that has been a very, very powerful influence on me. And in the process of working, of being a scholar and being on the selection committee, I learned to know a lot of the leadership, business leadership in North Carolina, who served on the board, on the selection committee, or served on the board of the foundation, mm-hmm. or in any other way had a relationship to that program. And that goes to the research triangle, which we haven't gotten to yet, but still, it gave me as an academic an unusual association and intimacy with the business leadership of North Carolina. Virtually all the bankers I know personally and have a good personal relationship with, many of the manufacturers, mm-hmm. And other leaders of the state. So the Moorhead thing and the work with the Research Triangle and its various forms, whether you're talking about the park, the institute, or some other things, I feel like I've had a very unusual opportunity that most of my colleagues on the faculty have not had. Mm-hmm. Plus the fact that, adding to that, I know I'm wandering a little bit, but in 1972, Chancellor Farabee Taylor asked me to join his administration as a vice chancellor to be responsible for research administration, development, and public service. And I was saluted quarter deck if I was asked to do anything, so not that I had any particular skills in those areas, but I took it. And then that gave me even more association with the leadership in North Carolina. And I wouldn't take anything for these experiences that gave me as a faculty member a personal relationship with the leadership of the state. I've had some recent illness from surgery, and a former head of one of the major power companies came to visit me at home. Brought me a copy of Friedman's book on a desk. you know, and that touches you.
Yeah. We noticed you started in physical chem and then moved to orgo.
Physical chemistry because of my interest in mathematics.
Yeah.
But I did not find research in physical chemistry as exciting as working with real chemicals at the lab bench. And so when I finished my master's, in those days you took the master's first and then took the PhD. You didn't skip the master's. That came later. But when that change came, I changed to organic, and I don't regret that.
So part of that change was finding a PhD advisor. Who did you work with?
I worked with Arthur Rowe, R-O-E.
Mm-hmm.
Arthur Rowe was an aromatic fluorine chemist. And I worked with making some fluorine heterocycles, particularly of phenothiazines. Those compounds in those days were exciting because a chloro derivative, okay, all right, a chloro derivative, chlorpromazine, was rather new as a treatment for certain mental illnesses. And also, phenothiazines were very important in oil lubricants as an antioxidant. And the whole notion was, how can fluorine affect some of these properties, as it does in steroids? There are many fluorosteroids, you're probably aware of that, where fluorine makes a big difference. And in the case of phenothiazines, it didn't show any particular enhanced activity. But the process of getting there was interesting.
But were you enjoyed the stuff? But were you passionate about the chemistry, the research? Were you?
Yeah. Oh yes. Oh yeah. I worked 18-hour days, 7 days a week. Tried not to work on Sunday mornings. Our department chair, Ralph Dost, was a Lutheran like myself, and he was a real stickler, so he didn't really want us working in the labs on Sunday. And I never forget when he was ill, he had a fungal infection in his lungs that took his life. But I went to visit him one Sunday afternoon, and in those days, you did that. But I stopped by the lab to change a desiccant and a desiccator, and I needed to dry something with some acetone. I did that. Now, when I went to his house, sat down and started talking to him, I looked down, and a big chunk of my trousers leg was dissolved away. This was a rayon acetone, and I'd spilled some acetone. I looked at that, I was horrified. But at any rate, no, I enjoyed my lab work, and I worked around the clock. It was pretty much.
How did, at that moment, how did people in the chemistry department view themselves in relation to the competition in the big world? We're somewhat still in the old South.
Yeah, we were in the old South, but then there were a lot of other things that were quite different in those days. For example, in those days, there probably weren't more than 40 or 50 PhD programs in chemistry in the whole country. Maybe fewer. I don't remember looking it up in the Directory of Chemical Research. I don't even know whether it existed in those days. But there weren't that many places. The overriding thought, though, was if you're going to get a PhD in chemistry, and if you're going to work in industry, you're going to have to go to the Northeast. I mean, there was a little bit of activity in North Carolina at the tobacco companies. American Inca had a rayon plant up in the mountains west of Asheville for making tire cords. Did a little bit of research, but there wasn't much research in chemistry in North Carolina or the Southeast. So, I was pretty certain I wanted to go into academics. But at the same time, in my terminal year of graduate work, I thought at least I ought to take a look at industry. In those days, recruiting a PhD chemist was very, very difficult because there just weren't that many being produced. Unlike what happened in the later 60s when every institution in the country set up a PhD program. So I would talk with recruiters and I'd say, look, I know I'm going into academics, but if you want me to visit, I'll be happy to come. But you've got to know up front what my intentions are. And they were very happy. That's fine, because if you go into teaching, we would be interested in your students. So I took about 6 or 8 trips, which was a standard number. Wasn't a large number in those days.
Places like?
Union Carbide, Procter & Gamble, Roman Haas.
Did you go to Midland, Michigan to
Dow? No, I went to Midland when I was recruiting for the Research Triangle. There were half a dozen. I've kind of forgotten what some of them were. Oh, I went to DuPont, of course. And so I realized, if I'm going into industry, there's no place in North Carolina. Of course, that had a later impact on my interests. I think you can see what I'm getting at. But those trips were sufficiently interesting to me that I said, you know, I better go take a postdoc and take this over. So I applied for a postdoc at University College in London. Oh, it must have been in the spring or summer of my last year. Had no opportunity to apply for a fellowship. NSF was just starting some, but I had missed all the deadlines. So I took all the money I'd saved by having a Morehead scholarship and paid my own way to University College, spent a year, probably the most influential year of my life, because it gave me a chance to get away from the Southeast, look back and see how different the world is. And in those days, see, just before I got there in the fall of 54, rationing went off. And that was 10 years after World War II. And London was still strewn with rubble from the war. My colleagues in the laboratory, I have to say this, all look malnourished.
Obesity wasn't a problem.
Not a problem. And even though they loved to load up their tea with sugar, it was a reaction to the absence of sugar during the war. So I developed a really great respect for the English people. I used to joke that the national sport's not cricket, it's queuing. And that on Sunday afternoons they queue around the fireplace just for the fun of it. But they were such orderly people. I mean, I don't know that that is inherent in the British psyche, because if you read British history, nothing suggests that. But the experience of World War II required it. They learned, they adapted to it, they learned it. They practiced it. And I'll tell you something else. It had a very profound effect on me. Growing up in a southern community, I had quite a vocabulary. And I'm talking about 4-letter words. Got to England, and when I started talking normally, I learned pretty quickly that you don't do that. It cleaned up my language. It really did, and to this day, I'm very careful about using 4-letter words. Very circumspect about where and what kind of occasion will allow me to do that. And I attribute that to my year in London with some wonderful, wonderful friends.
At the time that you took a postdoc, this would have been about 55, 56?
54-5, fall of 54, spring 55.
How many of the other people you finished grad school with took postdocs as opposed to taking jobs right away?
Not many.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't real common. It was, back in those days, most of the postdocs in this country were people who came from other countries to get experience in the American laboratories, U.S. laboratories. Some of my colleagues took postdocs, but not many. That changed drastically only 3 or 4 years later, when it became the ticket into academia.
And NSF was putting money in.
NSF was putting money into it. The growth of research grants following World War II.
And
the establishment of the National Science Foundation created a pool of money that faculty members could get to employ postdocs. But see, all that was the aftermath of World War II, after it was recognized that research is a very important factor in the economy of the country. That was learned during World War II, when all these things were developed, the Manhattan Project, you know, you name it.
Well, did you think about, since you were paying for your postdoc year, why didn't you think of Berkeley or Harvard or...
I wanted the overseas experience, one. Secondly, I was very impressed with the work of Ingold and Hughes, particularly on aromatic nitration. And thirdly, I had a professor, Joe Bennett, who later went to Brown University and now is retired from California, not Riverside, Santa Cruz. He had been in the University College Laboratory and talked to me a lot about it.
Who else was in people postdocing at UC? Were they mainly English, or were they mainly overseas?
No, they're. When I think the two that come to mind, one was taking a sabbatical from Johns Hopkins, and the other was taking a sabbatical from Kenyon College in Ohio, Gambier, Ohio. They were the two U.S. Now there was another who was a fellow who was on sabbatical from Haifa in Israel, who became a real good friend. I'm just trying to think who else was there as a postdoc, but the other postdocs were all on sabbatical from another educational institution. The postdoc straight from graduate school, I don't think was all that common in those days. But it didn't take long before it became very common. I mean, really a ticket to academia.
Were you single at this point?
Yes. I was not married. I later, after that year in England, I taught a year at Reed College and then was invited back to the faculty at Chapel Hill. A couple of years later, met my wife, who was working for the News Bureau at the university.
That was comparatively unusual in that era. That was an early marriage era.
I didn't understand.
People were getting married much younger in that era.
Yeah, they were. I was married at age 28, I think, which is a little bit late because I considered marriage incompatible with graduate work and postdocing. Economically, it wasn't feasible.
Yeah. That's another kind of great shift in reality.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you see, you'll find this interesting. As you know, more and more people who do graduate work, and this means our prospective faculty members, have gotten married during graduate work, and frequently to another chemist or another person with a PhD, so that if you're going to hire a person, whether it be the man or the woman, you got to find two jobs. And did you know that even before that became common, one of the selling points that we made in selling the research triangle was, look, we've got three universities and some colleges in the area, and we've got opportunities for spousal employment. We didn't use that word, we said your wife's employment in those days. But it was a selling point that there are opportunities for a couple in chemistry or physics or whatever it might be with these universities and what we expect to have in the park. And that was a pretty far-looking argument because the notion of gender equality was not yet on the horizon. Or it wasn't obvious, anyhow, maybe on the horizon. There were a lot of writers that were... Well, that was before Betty Friedan's book, long before that, but it was not before Simone de Beauvoir's book, the French.
Yes, yeah, you know. But that was just crazy thinking.
Well, it was crazy in its time, but it was the forerunner of what happened.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, many of the good things that happen start with crazy ideas. I mean, we have to acknowledge that.
Did you apply to Reed College, or did they come to you?
They came to me.
While you were in London?
Yeah. And the reason they came to me was that my former professor, not my thesis advisor, but Joe Bennett, whom I mentioned, who had taught at Reed, had recommended to Arthur Scott, who was chair of the department, that you ought to look at Bill Little. Now, what was interesting was, when I was hired at Reed College, there were two of us whose assignment was freshman chemistry. We jointly taught the course. My colleague was John Hancock, a Britisher. John Hancock came from a postdoc at Yale. I came from a postdoc in London. And so when we met our class, and here's Bill Little from London, and here's John Hancock from Yale, and the accents were so incongruent that it took a long time for the class to figure it out. But it was fun.
Reed's well known as a small liberal arts school, right?
I mean, absolutely. And the finest in the country. At that time, their graduates had the highest percentage of Rhodes scholarships of any institution in the country, and had the highest percentage of their graduates going on to graduate and professional school. They had research as a requirement for the undergraduate degree with a thesis, a defense of the thesis. Fantastic institution. I wouldn't take anything for that year's experience. It, again, had a big impact on my performance as a faculty member.
Were they expecting research from you? Or
yes. And I didn't get anywhere with this, but I was interested in a compound called apocynol. It's a phenolic material with a side chain that's a byproduct of paper, a pulping of wood. It has some relevance to the Pacific Northwest. And I was trying to find materials that would react with apocynol to form a water-soluble material, and hoping I could break down cellulose, lignin, with whatever I learned. But that, I didn't get very far with that. But then when I came to Chapel Hill, I got interested in ferrocene. It was fairly newly discovered. And I had a lot of fun exploring ferrocene chemistry, which later led to an interest in transition metal organometallics generally, and toward the end, before I got too much into administration, I was working with analogs of vitamin B12, which is a cobalt surrounded by a ligand that will form carbon to cobalt bonds. It's the only carbon, it's the only metal to carbon bond that's found in nature, I think, or it was then. And what I was doing was using that as I was. It's vitamin B12 is a square planar complex of cobalt, and I was building ligands that would force it out of coplanarity. And the idea was to expose two coordination sites and then try to polymerize olefins by getting to coordinate here, join, pop off, and then... And we had some success. We got some compounds up to C20 from C2, but never got a high polymer. Later, a colleague of mine built further on the idea with some quite different compounds and wound up with a process that would make that would dimerize acrylic acid to dicarboxylic acid that was valuable in making nylons, and DuPont licensed it but has never really implemented it. But my colleague made some great strides, but some using totally different systems. I didn't mean to suggest that he was using my ideas, but it just, when I kind of went back into administration, my colleague kind of started some work that was similar to what I was doing and made it work.
At the time you're doing this work, this is right around when the organic metallics, it's beginning of what becomes metals in biology as a field. And I guess there's a bit of a dispute at the time between Pauling and the people up in Copenhagen around ligand field theory. Did that play out at all in your work, or were you really, you were looking more applied?
We were much more applied. I don't know that any of that really affected how people did organometallic chemistry. Maybe how they explained it. But I don't know that it led to any laboratory practices. I'm not sure. As a matter of fact, I don't remember. Pauling had so many interests. Including vitamin C. Oh, I'll never forget. When I was at Stanford, I took a leave of absence at Stanford after I'd been department chair. And that was when Pauling was at Stanford. And it's when he was doing his vitamin C work. And there are two things I remember. One of them was going into a drugstore and seeing posted on a bulletin board there a letter from Pauling that he wrote to all the Bay Area drugstores saying, "You better stock up on vitamin C. My book's coming out and there'll be a run on it." The other thing I remember, the anecdote I remember, was that he ordered some vitamin C. And the supplier misplaced the decimal by maybe three places. And he wound up with a room full of vitamin C for $150.
Who recruited you back to UNC?
My thesis director, Arthur Rowe, who was chairman of the department at that time.
Was the department expanding, or what was the context?
No, there had been an organic chemist who had resigned. There was an opening. At that time, I was considering an offer from another institution, and I'd sought the advice of my former mentor. And he wrote back and said, well, before you do anything, would you consider coming back here? I think I wired him yes.
Why Why were you even considering leaving Reed?
I'm sorry?
Why were you even considering leaving Reed?
The attractiveness of Chapel Hill. I wouldn't have gone anywhere else.
But it was just the market was buoyant. I mean, you were being... You say you were...
Let me say one thing. I'll explain about that Reed situation. I mentioned there were two of us who taught freshman chemistry. One of us was replacing a faculty member who had resigned. And the other was a Ford Foundation teaching internship. Now, neither of us knew or ever knew who was which.
Right.
But it was clear that at some point during that spring, there was going to have to be a decision made. Well, I wasn't so worried about that decision because the attractiveness... Well, I wanted to come back to North Carolina. Mm-hmm. Much as I love the Pacific Northwest, the weather was too much like that of London. Wet, damp, with the advantage that in those days, you didn't come home with your collar black. Now, of course, London's done a magnificent job of cleaning up. But in those days, they still had the family hearth burning soft coal. And particularly if you went to a small community at night, it was just laden.
Oh, yeah.
You remember what it was like?
Yeah.
Portland was very clean. But at the same time, I'm a little bit of a sun worshiper. Temperature-wise, Portland and North Carolina, about the same.
Yeah.
Precipitation-wise, about the same. It's the distribution over time.
So this was 56 you came back?
Yeah, I came back in the fall of 56.
So you were perfectly positioned for Sputnik.
You got it. When the research triangle started, there was already a scarcity of PhDs. And then when Sputnik went up, that exacerbated the situation. So the Fed started all these new fellowship programs, NSF, National Defense Education Act, NIH, to try to build up more graduate work in the sciences. And that was when there was this vast expansion of graduate programs in the late 60s. Fortunately, for two reasons, the research triangle started when it did. One, PhDs were still scarce. And I could write to the director of research of Allied Chemical and saying, well, be in New York the week of July 18th. Could I have a few minutes to tell you about something we're doing here in North Carolina? Signed, little assistant professor of chemistry. Response, sure, let's go to lunch. The other thing is home air conditioning became feasible.
Yeah, when did that come in?
In the 50s.
Yeah.
And if we had to offer people who were recruiting to work in the research triangle to our beastly summers without air conditioning, it never would have worked.
How did it go back to when you're a graduate student and so on, and that earlier time? What did happen in the dog days? In the lab, were people in there getting hot and bothered?
We just had to sweat it out. And it was worse than that. In those days, state regulations would not allow screens on state buildings. The windows of state buildings. And when you work with ammonia in a laboratory, you attract all the flies in the county. It was hell. And wasps. But, you know, you survived it.
Did Duke have screens?
Duke, in those days, the Duke Chemistry Department was right near the Duke Chapel, and they had all this Gothic construction. And we used to say that Duke has the only chemistry building in the country that's fully equipped to ward off an archery attack.
So you're back at UMC, and it's a mix of teaching and research.
Yep.
And what's the moment when somebody comes to you and says, we'd like to put you in a bit of an administrative role?
Well, the first thing that happened was in the fall semester of my first year, my chairman called me in and said, "Bill, you know what the research triangle is?" I said, "Yeah, it's teaching, research, and I can't think of the third one." "No, it's not that." He says, "There's an effort underway to try to promote this area for research laboratories. And Professor George Simpson of the Sociology Department is heading up a committee that the governor has established and that a Winston-Salem banker has funded to try to promote the area for research labs. They're looking for somebody to travel and visit the chemical industry. Would you be interested in doing that?" I said, "You better believe it." Because I'd faced the problem of no opportunity in North Carolina. And I also felt that if we really did develop research laboratories in this area, we could hold our heads a little bit higher. When I recruited for industrial positions before, sometimes I'd ride to the interviews with a carpool and somebody would say, "Well, what's it like down there in the sticks?" And that kind of burned into my mind, and I wanted to get even. So I had a lot of reasons for saying, "Hey, I'd love to see this happen. I can see what it would do for the university, the chemistry department, for the young people in North Carolina. I'm not interested myself in going into this industry, and I know I'm where I want to be, but I'd sure like to help change things." And so I agreed to travel.
What's part of the incentive? Did you get time off teaching, or did you
the arrangement was this. It was a multi-pronged program. First, I would collar all the industrial recruiters who came to interview for PhDs and tell them about what we're trying to do, and then later give them brochures when we had them to carry back. It was a promotional effort. Secondly, I'd travel during the summertime to visit companies, and I was paid a stipend for doing that.
So it was a summer job, was it?
It was a summer job, yeah. And thirdly, the Triangle would send me to any national meeting of the American Chemical Society, and I'd visit companies while I was there, whether it be New York or Cleveland. Miami didn't offer many opportunities, but while at those meetings I would also talk with chemists I know that are in industry. We would always have UNC alumni luncheons, which would have a collection of people from a lot of companies, and I'd tell them what we're trying to do, and they'd say, "Look, if it works, let us know, because we'd like to come back to North Carolina." It was almost without exception that people wanted to come back.
Tell us the pitch you were making at the time. I mean, was it focused?
We were saying, "Look, we have a great location. We're on the axis from Atlanta to Richmond, to Washington, to Boston, built Baltimore. We've got two rail lines." We didn't even mention the airport. We're singing that up. "We've got two rail lines that run right past where we are. We've got a low cost of living," and we had a three or four page brochure that showed the price of eggs here and versus other places, cabbage, whatever. We've got clean air. The problems of the cities, smog and so on, are just being recognized. We've got air conditioning. We've got three universities that offer all kinds of cultural activities. We have a state art museum, a state symphony orchestra. So we've got all these cultural amenities, but we don't have the problems of the cities. Great climate. We're 2 or 3 hours from the mountains, 2 or 3 hours from the coast.
Well, the other thing that you're playing right into is this is the baby boom and suburbanization era.
Yes.
Not the city. Yeah.
But the pitch didn't exactly take off like wildfire. I mean, as I read the RTP history, it went nowhere fast.
Well, it went nowhere fast, but as a result of my visit to what was then Atlas Chemical Industries, one of the spinoffs from DuPont that later was bought by Bluewater in England, Walter Rugeberg, whom I met there, and he was director of research and something of that sort, he came to visit. During the first summer, Texaco came to visit. Now, that wasn't my trip, but George Simpson had, and it's interesting, this is very interesting, a fellow by the name of McKinley came and visited. And we didn't have a park then. We just showed him the area, and we had got the Chamber of Commerce directors to behave like gentlemen toward each other from Durham and Raleigh, which is a no mean feat. While I was at Reed College, a real buddy of Arthur Scott, who was my department chair and probably my most important mentor, loved that man. He had a good friend by the name of Walter Kuhn. Walter Kuhn was from Portland, but he was also general manager for research of Texaco. And when I went to the fall ACS meeting in New York, had dinner with Scotty and Walter Kuhn, I said to Mr. Kuhn, I said, you know John McKinley, don't you? He said, yeah, he works for me. I said, well, did you know he visited our area this summer? He said, yes, and you came in second. So, we had responses to those visits early on, enough to give, if you look at it as a feasibility study, we were getting positive results.
Well, in these visits, you were saying to people, come set up a lab down here.
Well, our pitch was this: we never ask anybody to move a laboratory. Now, that was canon. But we said, if you're going to expand and you're looking for other locations, we want to be on your list. It was that simple. And of course, research was trying to expand in those days if they could get the people.
Yeah.
And then we said, you know, we've got the people. And we had opportunities for spousal employment. We used a different term, as I mentioned earlier. But I mean, all that was part of the pitch.
Yeah. And jump forward a long way. A lot of corporations have been downsizing their research in
recent
years. Has that affected what's been happening here?
We had the best year we've ever had this past year. Okay. We're down to 10% of our holdings left. We've doubled the price on the land, and it hadn't slowed down the activity.
Go back into the startup. It's interesting me reading some of the stuff that this actually came out of. This was a social science vision. This was Odom and the Institute for Social Research.
We got to be careful about that. Odom's role has become a bit apocryphal. Odom was a very, very powerful and salutary force on this university. When you were talking about earlier at lunch about what makes North Carolina different, I mentioned Frank Graham, but I should have mentioned Howard Odom, because he was heading up the Sociology Department and the newly formed Institute for Research in Social Science. And he was pushing for integration in the 30s. He was pushing for industrialization of the South. And in some places you will read, it will give him credit for the idea of the research triangle, but that's wrong. He envisioned a research program of some sort between UNC at Chapel Hill and North Carolina State, focusing mostly on the sociology of the South, not the technical industrialization. Now, Odom's biggest influence, though, was that George Simpson, the sociologist who headed the governor's committee and who I worked for, was an Odom product.
But he understood that it was scientific, actual science.
Absolutely. And he's the first one to try to correct the allegation that Odom was the source of the idea of the research triangle. Odom had an idea, but it was quite a different idea. Yeah. So that needs to be dispelled. The real origin of the idea was an industrial contractor by the name of Romeo Guest, who was a graduate of MIT, whose business was building industrial plants, principally in the textile industry.
That's why he was down here.
Mm-hmm. Well, Romeo Guest's operation was in Greensboro, to the west of here. But he had been trained at MIT, and he saw what happened in the Long Route 128. And he thought the same thing could happen here. And he even published a brochure, North Carolina's Golden Research Triangle, promoting this area. And he got to Governor Hodges, got his ear. And Hodges at first was reluctant, but later was kind of won over. And the program was started with the support of Robert Haynes of Wachovia Bank and Winston-Salem, who headed up the governor's committee and was a powerful force in North Carolina. So Romeo Guest coined the term research triangle, but he also had a strictly business interest in doing that. He wanted to build the plants.
So if we follow the money for a minute, it's a great American story because it's real estate speculation.
Originally, the land that is now the Research Triangle consisted of some purchases and options that a New York former textile executive secured. This New York Robbins was his name. He had a very successful business operation in North Carolina. There's a town name for him, Robbins, North Carolina. And he was induced by a friend of the governor's to make an investment in purchases and options of land that was to be called Pine Lands Incorporated. And so we were out promoting Pine Lands, a private venture. Now,
was there at this moment some state money in there?
No.
Who?
Zero.
So, whose money is it? Who's?
Well, initially it was Robbins' investment. And a little bit of stock that was purchased by some local people. Robbins had promised $1 million, invested about a half a million. But then, before he invested the rest, he wanted to see more participation in North Carolina.
So this is actually a business, if I say it crudely, this is a business venture in the boondocks by someone from the big city.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Okay. It's exactly what it was. And when Robbins was reluctant to put the rest of his commitment in, Robert Haynes, who was chairman of Wachovia Bank, at that time ill with cancer, and Luther Hodges went to visit Haynes's anointed successor at Wachovia Bank, Archie Davis, down at the beach, and wanted Archie to go across the state selling stock in Pine Lands. And Archie said, "Gentlemen, I can't do it." He said, I just cannot try to get people to buy stock in a company where our public universities are doing the selling, to promote it." He said, "That ain't right. I'll tell you what I can do. I believe that I can raise money as contributions to buy out Robin's investment and make it a public service opportunity." So the governor and Bob Haynes said, "Well, go to it." And in 60 days, Archie raised $1.8 million, which today, in today's dollars, would be $18 million. So this single-handedly, virtually. Now, he had a little help in some cities.
So this does say something about cohesion in the state business community.
It certainly does. And also, the Triangle communities contributed only about 20%. Winston-Salem was the biggest contributor. And there were contributions from up in Canton, North Carolina, which is in the western end of the mountains, all the way down to Elizabeth City on the coast and Wilmington.
Is this in which year? 57. 58.
So this, in part, among other things, this is post-Sputnik. But at that point, Sputnik didn't have that much impact on raising this money because the general public didn't realize what the shortage of PhD scientists was doing. And we did in academia.
No. But you were already hired earlier than this?
Yeah, 56, yeah.
So this was, if I'm on some conflict of interest committee today, I say, "Bill Little or someone, you're in breach of regulation."
I don't know that you're in breach of regulation, but you're probably in breach of the spirit of regulation. I don't think there's anything that addressed this directly.
Yes.
But yes. I mean, the accusation, that was what Archer Davis was saying.
But it worked.
Yeah, but it worked.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I traveled in the summertime, I was paid by the foundation, or was the forerunner of the foundation, not the university.
Which was what? What was that entity?
Hmm?
What was that entity?
It was the Research Triangle Committee, Inc., Incorporated, which later changed its name to Research Triangle Foundation.
So that was a non-profit?
It was non-profit. Yes, but but the non-profit was promoting a private real estate venture.
Yeah.
And that's what Archer Davis had objections to.
Right.
Because he loved the universities. After he left the being CEO of Wachovia Bank, he came to Chapel Hill as a graduate student in history. And he completed a master's degree and then worked toward a PhD degree. And we've got lots of ABDs, all but dissertations. Well, Archie was an ABC. He didn't take all the coursework, but he wrote two dissertations and published both of them, but never got his PhD because he didn't take all the courses. Couldn't find a parking place. So he was quite a guy. And then some years later, in 1975, when the foundation was getting out from under its development debt and some mortgages, it set up something called the Triangle University Center for Advanced Studies, Incorporated, which is about 120 acres, beautiful land in the park. We will visit it when we go to the Humanities Center. To be land that the universities could use for joint activities, things they want. This was set up in 75, and the Humanities Center was then being promoted by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Bids were being made by Stanford, Texas, you name it. So we put in a bid. And our point was, several fold. First off, Archie would raise, what was it, $1.5 million for the building, which he did in 30 days. The universities would provide collectively 5 years operating expenses for the administration of the program. We're given the land, $1.5 million toward the building, and we won it. And that became one of Arch's biggest lifelong interests for the remainder of his life. Now, on that land that the three universities have, we have the Humanities Center, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, the Microelectronics Center of North Carolina, the National Institute for Statistical Sciences, and the Statistics and Mathematics, SAMC, Mathematical Sciences Institute, and the Burroughs Wellcome Fund.
And though some of that connects in some way to SAS.
No, not really. Well, SAS is interested in the Statistics Institute.
That's what I was thinking.
That's right. But they have not been to my knowledge, they have not been a contributor.
But it helps the critical mass.
Oh, absolutely. Well, see, statistics has been strong historically at Chapel Hill and State. We had a joint program back in the 50s as one of the first mathematical statistics programs in the country. And then biostatistics has been very strong in our Chapel Hill Medical School of Public Health. And then the Research Triangle Institute got started with a statistics and operations group. So we've got strong statistics here and had some real giants in the field.
I have a daughter-in-law who's a PhD in statistics from NC State.
Okay, yeah. Well, may have worked for Gertrude Cox, who was the real leader at State and who contributed half of her research program to start the Research Triangle Institute. Spent half her time at the Institute and then later became full-time at RTI, and for whom the Gertrude Cox building is named. So they had a strong program.
Go back into that early period. What are the first two or three clear successes?
The first major success, or you might say, and this is a quick throwaway, is the Research Triangle Institute. It was the first occupant of Research Triangle Park, and about a third of the money that Archie raised went to start the Institute, which was a powerful statement of what the founders of the Research Triangle believed, that they would invest a third of their money to start a research institute.
And this is like Battelle or SRI.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it did, probably modeled after SRI.
So it did some contract research?
Contract research, yeah. Mostly, about 90% federal work, but they do some industrial work as well. Mm-hmm. And they do work for state governments, particularly in the field of education. But also in drug abatement, or the use of drug, the ways to counter the use of drugs. They have real strong programs in anti-drug research.
Illegal drugs.
Illegal drugs. Yes. Yeah. Not pharmaceuticals.
Right.
But the first success was the Chemstrand Corporation. Chemstrand Corporation was in Decatur, Alabama. They were a joint venture of American Viscose and Monsanto. The very first person I talked to when I started work for the Research Triangle was in January of 57, first month that I was officially associated with it. I went to lunch with a fellow by the name of Bruce Ballantyne, PhD graduate from our department, worked for Ken Strand in Alabama, where a number of our other graduates were. I told him what we were trying to do, and he was very excited. He said, keep me posted. A year later, in January, he came back interviewing, and by that time I had brochures. And I gave him some brochures. He said, well, I'm going to take these back and show them to my boss. He did. And a month or so later, we got a letter from his boss saying he wanted to come take a look. So his boss, by the name of David Cheney, with one associate who had been director of research at Ford Motor Company, I think, came and spent two or three days. And Tim Strand decided to come, build about 400 acres, and built a big laboratory, the first major laboratory in the park. Now, some years later, Bruce Valentine told me in a line at the grocery store in Chapel Hill, said, Bill, I said, I want to tell you a story. I said, yeah. He said, you know, when you gave me those brochures on the research triangle, we had already made a decision to go to Princeton. And it was going to go to the board in June. But there's a man on our board by the name of Frank Sode. He's a polymer chemist and also an archaeologist of a sort, or anthropologist. Studied the American Indians in the Southwest and in Alabama and Mississippi. Frank Sode likely had asked the question, did you look at that thing in North Carolina? And my boss felt he'd better be prepared to say, yeah, we went up there. But they came and made a visit, and they changed their recommendation. And I would venture that without that decision, which was made in 1959 or 1960, triangle might not have worked because the land was mortgaged. That's another story. That's why it was mortgaged. I'll tell you that in a minute. But the land was mortgaged, and there wasn't another major laboratory till IBM made this decision in 1965, so 5 years later. I don't know that they had the resources to span that time without going to the state, maybe getting state help, I don't know, but at no point was any state money invested in the triangle effort except the following. When we got the National Institute for Environmental Health Sciences, in those days, if you got a federal lab, you had to provide them with land. The triangle gave them 400 acres. The state reimbursed the foundation for that gift, because otherwise they'd have to have done it. Another thing that Terry Sanford did when he was governor to help us meet our payroll and all, and our other debts, he bought the corridor for I-40 through the park way ahead of schedule to help, you know, for cash flow purposes.
What was the cash being spent on? What was the cash being spent on?
Staff and mortgage.
Staff doing what?
For the staff of the foundation that was
trying to promoting.
Yeah. When Robbins gave up his land and his options, the money that Archie raised was not to buy that land or to buy those options. Robbins took notes, unsecured notes. Allegedly, he was going to forgive those notes. We don't know. But I've heard that. I can't track it down. But the money that Archie raised was used to put infrastructure in. We had to bring in water from Durham. We had to hire a professional staff to promote the triangle. We had to do all kinds of land planning, which is expensive, you know, expenses. Robbins died unexpectedly, about 2 years after the land had been transferred, and his estate called in the notes. So then Archie had to put together a consortium of about 8 banks and insurance companies to buy a mortgage or to provide a mortgage for the foundation. Now the foundation had mortgage payments to pay. And so
it's using Walter's money.
Huh? Yeah, that's right. But Kim Strand was very successful. They developed AstroTurf here.
Yeah.
So, and then later, Monsanto bought out American Viscose many years later. And then Monsanto operated it as a materials lab for a number of years and then moved it to St. Louis to incorporate it into their central research.
In that early period, who's the hero? Who's the central figure? Who's the believer in all this venture?
The standard answer to that question that just about anybody will give you is lots and lots of people. The sine qua non was Archie Davis, because he raised the money. But there was Romeo Guest, who came up with the idea and convinced the governor. There was Luther Hodges, who promoted it. And, you know, he's the one that started trade missions first to New York and then to Europe before any other governors were doing that kind of thing. So he's a hero. There's Watts Hill in Durham, who is chairman of Central Carolina Bank, who played some very important roles. There was George Simpson, who had the ability to get all these business people to work together. I mean, he was a bit of a glue.
If you looked at the 10, 20, 30 key players, what fraction are North Carolina natives like yourself?
Almost all of them.
So they've got religion in a way that never happened in Alabama or Mississippi or something.
Yeah. You know, it's not an accident that North Carolina, a very poor state, third lowest per capita per family income, whatever, when this thing got started, still had the first state symphony orchestra, the first state art museum.
First state university.
First state university. And shortly after this started, the first residential school for the performing arts in Winston-Salem. And the first science high school. State-supported science high school. I mean, that's not an accident.
Now, if North Carolina were peopled by Puritans, I could understand it. What's the alternative explanation? What's
North Carolina's a curious mix. Depends on Joe Templeton. Told me something 6 months ago that I had never realized. He'd just gotten back from a year with NSF. I don't know what led to this. He said, you know, North Carolina is very different than any other state I'm aware of because people identify with the county they come from. He said, that's not true in Iowa where I grew up. I got to think of that. That's right. I'm a Catawba County boy. I've always considered myself a Catawba County boy. And these Burke County boys right next door, they're ruffians. And in Alexander County, they're all bootleggers. And that's where auto racing started because they had these souped up automobiles to carry the bootleg, the moonshine. And every county's got its own characteristics. And people identify what the county they're from. Mention was made of Lowry Caudill, who made $300 and some million off of his startup company, Magellan Labs. Well, he's a Cleveland County boy down in Shelby, not far from where I grew up, who had an opportunity to come back to North Carolina and work for Glaxo before spinning off his own starting up his own company. And there are just dozens and dozens of several situations where people went to NC State, for example, went to Princeton for the PhD, but came back and is working in the Triangle. I've got a nephew for whom that. It's interesting that I don't know how we got into that. The counties are very prominent in the psyche of North Carolinians.
Go to another strand, which is, why do you think Chemstrand came here, not Princeton? Was it because of having PhDs from UNC?
I think probably that must have been a factor, that they must have put a lot of pressure on Dave Chaney, who was head of the lab. But at the same time, you can't make a decision that way in industry. There have to be other things that you tell your board. And cost of living must have been a consideration. Climate, ability to attract people to a non-metropolitan but culturally advantaged area. Coastal and mountain access that you don't have to the same degree in New Jersey. You got they have a nice coast, but they haven't got the mountains. I wouldn't give you anything for them. And besides, I wouldn't want to live in. Well, Princeton's pretty nice, but there are areas of New Jersey I don't think I could live in. But anyhow, I don't know what all went into their decision, but I'm sure that was one factor. Their employees. But there had to be more if you're going to convince your board. Yeah. Now, the board may have been made up largely of Southerners. I don't know the board.
Yes.
I think Frank Soday was on the board, and he was a professional Southerner.
Mm-hmm. Around about 1960, there must have been a good supply of people saying, this is all crazy. It's a mistake.
My recollection of that is that people in general thought it was a good idea, didn't understand it. But my colleagues in chemistry would always, the department wasn't very large in those days, and we'd always eat at a big table in the Carolina Inn. And they'd say, Bill, you're wasting your time. Nobody's going to come bring their labs here. Mm-hmm. And then one by one over time they come back and said, Bill, you know, you were right.
When you had meetings and were in the sort of planning stage and you're in the room with some of the people from the state and then some of the other scientists, right, Simpson and these.
Yeah.
Was there any conversation about other industrial parks around the country?
There weren't many.
Right.
There was Stanford. Princeton was starting their Forrestal Park about the same time. Swear Engine in Oklahoma, a year ahead of us, and in Alabama, around the space agency at Huntsville, they were starting one. And that was about it. There was something at Cornell, but that really was as I understand it, was really a business park for insurance companies and this sort of thing, not so much for hard science. But there wasn't any competition. If we'd waited 10 more years or 15 more years, it might not have worked. Timing is right, because there was very little competition. Stanford's research park was directed towards utilizing excess land. They couldn't sell their land because of the Stanford will. And so they had to find ways to get income. And they built a big shopping center, which you may have been to, and that's been a producer. They have they do some farming on that land, but then they've got the Stanford Research Park, which is a good income producer.
Well, so there's not a lot of competition. There's also not a lot of sense of how to do it.
No.
Right? There's no textbook to follow.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, every now and then I was asked to go to a meeting to represent the foundation, a meeting on the subject of research parks. This would have been in the early 70s, perhaps. when there were some. And they'd always want the Research Triangle on the program because we were a forerunner and very successful. But they'd always schedule, when I was went to one at Princeton, scheduled me at night after dinner when there wouldn't be too many people there. And the real reason that I, what I doped out as the reason was that there was always a retinue of consultants ready and willing to tell you how to build a research park and what you ought to have in it. And of course, we didn't have any consultants. We did it ourselves. That didn't go over real big with the consultants, who had a fair amount of influence because they were putting up a lot of money it took to make these meetings work. So it was always interesting how I'd come back after dinner to give my talk. That was all right with me. I didn't care.
Go across to the department side. Well, with the in one way or another, you were engaged with the park from then till now, basically.
Yeah.
But that particular summer job only went on for what, half a dozen years?
2 years.
Two.
But my traveling to ACS meetings and this sort of thing went on for 3 or 4 years, 5 years maybe. But sooner or later I had to get back to my research. But I think that my work with the Research Triangle got me into administration in the university. For in the first administrative post was it in 1959, the university decided it needed an office to organize the processes for institutional approval of research grant applications to make sure that the whole bases had been touched, that there weren't commitments and proposals that the university had not been apprised of and where assurances had not been made. To make sure that the proposal was something that was academically sound and not going to be an embarrassment to the university, but also an office to assist in getting these things through the administrative processes, because in those days they would send a proposal to the chancellor and he'd send it maybe to the vice chancellor for business, or might send it to the dean of the graduate school, might send it God knows where to get everyone in the process. There are a lot of reasons why that was needed, and so I was asked to start that program under the dean of the graduate school, and the then chancellor at the time, who I considered to be the best chancellor we've ever had, Bill Aycock, now 90 years old, but I had lunch with him at one of his retirement communities a couple of weeks ago. He takes great pride in saying that during his whole chancellorship, he added only one person to the administration, and that was Bill Little. Well, that got me into the administration, and it gave me a vantage point over the entire university, medical school, the dental school, public health, arts and sciences, you name it. So that I quickly became quite familiar with all the academic units, their culture, what kind of work they do, and a general understanding of the university that I couldn't have had otherwise. I had a better vantage point of the university than any dean of the whole university.
Yeah.
So I think it was because of my work with the Research Triangle that I was asked to take on that task, and I did, and it was very successful. I only stayed there 2 years.
And that led to what?
I'm sorry? That well, then 3 years later, I was asked to chair the chemistry department. Mm-hmm. So I did that, and that's when we got our new building that really made a big difference. And also we had a whole bunch of hires. You see, I was chairman between 65 and 70, and that's when enrollments were growing, particularly in graduate programs, and we were hiring like, I hired 14 new faculty members. And they were all great.
And that was basically expanding.
Expanding to meet the increased enrollment, yes. And four of those people achieved National Academy. Mm-hmm. So I feel very good about my year as chairman of chemistry. And I think my colleagues do too, because you mean people like Joe and
David.
I'm just always warmly received by the chemistry department, and that means a lot to me. I feel like it's my department. I mean, I have a great deal of feeling of possession when it comes to that. But anyhow, I did that for 5 years, and then I got back into the lab. That was a full-time occupation in those days, because it was such a period of transition. We had such archaic policies. For example, when I became chairman, a faculty member could not hire a graduate student on a research grant.
Corrupting or what?
During World War II, there had been a faculty member that had a lot of contracts with the federal government on isolating some natural products from the barks of trees that might have anti-malarial or whatever. And because he had all his federal money, he bought up all the grad students, and that stung those who were left. And that policy was out of place in the 1960s, 65. I turned that one around. We got a new chemistry building appropriated. We made several senior level additions, which is not the tradition of the department, but at the same time hired some of the brightest young people in the country, who grew from assistant professor to National Academy. So there's been a real success story in that chemistry department.
Well, both in the department and in the university, there was some sort of cultural transition going on.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
Can you talk about that for a minute, some of the issues there?
Well, I mentioned a major one when I talked about the non-employment on a research grant, except in the summertime, but that was okay. We had an antiquated curriculum. We revised it totally, first at the undergraduate level, then at the graduate level. We presented the case and got funded a new chemistry building, which was the last state appropriated building for about 15 years because of budget problems. We won one of these science development awards that Lyndon Johnson had gotten NSF to have, and we invested that very wisely. It was an institutional grant that involved chemistry, physics, and the social sciences. And while the administration wanted us to use that to hire faculty members that would later be taken over by the university, because we had no way. What we did was to put emphasis on support personnel, secretarial, shop, and so on, with the university picking that up later. We invested in new hires by giving a faculty member, when he first arrived, money for a postdoc. In those days, if you would write a proposal asking for a postdoc and you never had one, it gets stricken. But if you say in this proposal, I have one postdoc to replace Dr. So-and-so, you go right through. And also, equipment money was very hard to come by, and so we were able to buy all kinds of equipment. And when you couple that with an equipment budget of $1 million in those days, that came with the new building, plus a big block contract we had jointly with physics and material science from ARPA, now DARPA, mm-hmm. which is one of the accomplishments when I was in research administration. The physicists and I wrote that proposal and won it. And Jack Kennedy announced the award when we were giving him an honorary degree. But anyhow, these kinds of things were tools that helped build a great department. And I also started a policy that the department has followed of non-succession. That is to say, 5 years as chair, and that's it. You go out, get a new chair. That did lots of things. First place, it avoided a situation where you think you knew how to do it. That can be dangerous. Secondly, we had a fresh chairman every 5 years that was ready to take on the university. Over time, we've got one of the best cadres of leadership that you'll find everywhere. Both people that sat in here have been chairs of that department, Joe Templeton and Ed Smolsky, and both made very important contributions. But after 5 years, you know, it's time to get out and let a fresh person come in. And that philosophy the department has continued to this day.
In some of these national rankings that were done, and they were quite popular, I think, in the sort of 70s, 80s, where within the university did the chemistry department rank? That was it?
Pretty well.
There's always that sort of highest ranking department.
Oh, no, they're very hard to break into that group. We usually wind up in the top 20 of all institutions and the top dozen among state institutions, if you look outside. Now, within the university is your question.
Yeah.
University has long been strong in sociology because of Howard Odum, and it'll always be top two or three. Political science will always be high. Classics will always be high. Long tradition of strength in the classics. Physics has been low. Mathematics has been low. But physics has improved a lot in recent years. But within the university, we would probably be judged on those rankings, fifth or sixth, which is not bad.
So pretty important.
Yeah. And when it comes to winning external research support, we're in the top 20 nationally. Way ahead of Duke.
So in
chemistry.
So if you go in the southeast, this is probably the leading department.
Clearly.
Yeah.
Clearly, yeah. Duke has had a strong chemistry department historically. I think they went through a little bit of a slump 10 years ago. I think they're gaining new strength now.
Yeah. Wasn't Stan Tarbell?
Stan Tarbell.
Where was he?
Stan Tarbell was at Northwestern. And, you know, I think he went to Duke.
I'm thinking he was.
But died.
Yeah, I'm thinking he was one of our early supporters. I'm thinking this area, that's all, why I asked. Yeah, he probably went to. Was he Duke?
No.
Okay.
It might have been Tennessee.
It may have been, yeah.
I believe it was Tennessee. Okay. I'm thinking about somebody else that came to Duke and died, another prominent chemist. Who was that? Oh, God. It wasn't Tarbell. Tarbell had been at Northwestern before he went to Tennessee, I think.
I'm struck that after being chairman of the Department of Chemistry, then for 1 year you're chairman of the Division of Natural Sciences.
That doesn't mean a great deal. That role, there's certain process. Well, okay, if you're chairman of the division, it means you sit on a personnel committee that reviews tenure, promotions.
Okay. But then after that, you're for 5 years running up the Development and Public Service Office.
So. Yeah, and also, so, it doesn't say it there, but it's Research, Development, and Public Service.
Yeah.
Title didn't have the word research in it because it didn't sound like R&D. Crazy reasoning. But anyhow, I had the research responsibility too. Well, that's something that happened 4 or 5 years after I was chairman of the department. I was asked to do that, and whenever I was asked to do anything, I'd salute the quarterdeck and march forward. So I did that for 4 or 5 years.
How'd you find the development experience?
I made some reference to that earlier. It was, we conducted the first institution-wide capital funds campaign. So I had to learn how to do that, and I did. And we had a great success.
This is about when was it?
The early 70s.
Early 70s.
So what was the target sum?
I can't remember. It's something like $38 million, but we went over to goal. And that was pretty good for a first effort, 3 or 4 years. But that gave me an opportunity to learn to know the leadership of North Carolina again. Because they were the ones, you know, if you're going to have a campaign, you got to have a lay leadership. The head of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, the head of Wachovia Bank, the head of the Belk Department Stores, which is a great big chain across the state. The head of a lot of things, and got to know them all well, and they were always happy to find a faculty member that they thought was reasonably down to earth, not a cotton head. So, and those friendships have continued to this day. I mentioned that I had some surgery, and the former head of Carolina Power and Light came to visit me in my home and brought me a recording of Tom, what's his name's book, I believe. And at that time, I corrected an important problem the university had. The College of Arts and Sciences is the heart of the institution, and that's where all your undergraduates are, and undergraduates is one area where we've always excelled. If people would die and leave their money to the university is about 12 colleges or schools, including a medical school and so on.
Business school,
and so Mr. Pogue, who made his money one of the major banks, Morgan Stanley. Anyhow, he was head of oil for Morgan Stanley, I think it was. But anyhow, he left $12 million to the university at the time. That was while I was there. And that was the biggest gift we ever received. But it had to be divided among all the schools and units of the university because he left the university. But his whole interest was arts and sciences. But arts and sciences and the universities were synonymous. Now, every other school, except Arts and Sciences, had its own foundation, the Business Foundation, the Medical Foundation, Dental Foundation, and so on. So, I set as an objective to have an Arts and Sciences Foundation. And we worked that through the processes, got it. And now it's the second or third largest foundation that we've got at the university. And it just recently in the current campaign raised something like $60 million for arts and sciences programs. So now there's a distinction between the College of Arts and Sciences and every other school and college. So I thought that was an important move. The first fund capital campaign across the whole university. And we started a board of visitors, which was another opportunity to meet and work with the leadership of the state. And I've got so many good friends. I mean, for a long time, I chaired the nominating committee for the Research Triangle Foundation. And that was almost a one-man opportunity, activity. And so I could reach back to my old experience with the Board of Visitors and the campaigns and pick out people we ought to have on the board of the foundation that later became the leaders. The current chairman of the foundation is a fellow who was on our Board of Visitors. That's where I first got to know him, the most prominent lawyer in the state from down east, which is good because it involves the eastern part of the state. So all these experiences to me have been very satisfying. My chemistry may have suffered, indeed it did. But I don't think I have a colleague in the chemistry department that would say, Bill, I wish you had done something different.
No. When was the moment that you really sort of realized that, gee, you're not going to be a academic research chemist standard approved model?
The chairmanship of the department did a lot of damage. because in those days we had so many problems and so many opportunities that I gave it my full time. I did have a postdoc who helped with my research group that remained at the time, but over the 5-year period, I wouldn't take any new graduate students.
That's a long time in the life of science.
It's a long time in the life of science. Then I got back into it and changed my approach after a leave of absence at Stanford. But then when I was called back into the administration for the development and public service activity, that took its toll. And so that pretty much washed me up as a producing chemist. Mm-hmm. But at the same time all that was happening, I was gaining more and more responsibilities in the research triangle, mm-hmm. which by that time my colleagues respected and supported, so that it wasn't as though they suddenly had some dead wood. But
did anyone say to you along the way, gee, you should go get an MBA?
No.
Where'd you learn your strategic thinking and business?
Oh, I learned it from all the associations I had, but also a lot of it I just kind of had to develop myself. I mean, when I was chair of the chemistry department, I had to devise it. I did the first 5-year plan, where I got the whole department together and we doped out a plan. And basically the plan was, I can't remember all of it, but first we have to recognize that for teaching purposes we've got divisions, organic, inorganic, analytical, physical. We're going to emphasize in our hiring 4 areas. And it doesn't matter what division they might fall in, but we want to build strength in theoretical chemistry, coordination chemistry, the chemistry of excited states, and biologically related chemistry. You know, whether you're physical chemist, analytical, or organic, I mean, fit into any of these. Get out of the mold of just adding a organic chemist or an analytical. And we're going to revise our curriculum to reflect that, where most of the labs are jointly taught by more than one faculty member coming from different departmental divisions. We're going to make several senior additions to kind of break the mold of only hiring at the assistant professor level. And all this was with the full support of the department, see. We had a young group that were tigers and great. We had an older group that was going to seed. Now, to keep these in balance took some effort, but it worked. We managed to do it. But the old heads were not.
How did you keep the old heads entertained and out of mischief?
Because they were afraid of the alternatives to me. Frankly. I had their confidence, and so they put up with. I had to structure raises differently, and got away with it. Had to change that non-hiring of graduate students during the academic year.
Could you, in a state university, how much liberty do you have in setting faculty salaries on the individual level?
Oh, fair amount. The university, wisely, over the years, has always told the state that we do not want across-the-board increases, we want merit increases. Now, there have been times when we had stringent budget shortfalls, where the state just said we're going to give a 2% salary increase, but not less than $500. That kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But happened from time to time. But ordinary budgets, the university would always represent to the legislature that we want everything to be on merit, and the legislature's gone along with it. Except when they felt they had a PR problem with the state employees. Now, where we had our most trouble... Where we had our most... The trickiest thing to get around was state regulations regarding purchasing and construction. Classified personnel. It's hard to get the people in Raleigh, in the state personnel office in Raleigh, because that's who all the classified people work for, to know what a lab manager is. Or to know that a purchasing agent for the sciences is different from a purchasing agent for office supplies.
You haven't been able to put a whole set of people onto private money in some way.
I'm sorry?
You haven't been able to put a whole set of people just onto private money.
No. No, that hadn't been possible. The closest thing to that was when we put a whole bunch of people on our Science Development Award from the NSF, that the state, that the university would have to pick up based on what it got from the state.
In the long trajectory of things, state universities, are they a bargain for the state but not for the university? That is, they buy control for a small price these days.
Now wait a minute, I'm not sure I follow you.
Well, they buy control of the university, but what fraction of the budget does the state put in?
Well, that's a notion that gets played with by universities in a way that I'm not sure is fully straightforward. To answer your question, if you look at the expenditures, the state's putting up about 38%. The last time I saw the figure. But that means that every time you get a big research grant, you're cutting off the arm of the state a little bit, a finger at a time. The state pays for virtually all of the faculty salaries, except in areas like the medical school where clinical learnings are part of the formula that you pay an MD, dental school the same way. But in most departments, the entire faculty salary and benefits are paid by the state. Now, summer employment for 9-month appointees, you know, something different, but the basic salary is paid for by the state. The state has an equipment budget, which has improved over the years, but at the same time, I'm sure we're buying more equipment with external funds than we are with state funds. But again, when you say what percentage is paid for by the state, the answer will be misleading.
What you obviously had enormous success in academic administration on most every level.
I don't know, but it's been fun.
What's the secret to herding cats?
I'm sorry?
What's the secret to herding cats?
Oh. Or carrying cats in a wheelbarrow?
Yeah.
You've got to be scrupulously honest with your colleagues. You've got to try to get into their minds when you got a problem or an opportunity. You've got to win more battles than you lose externally. You've got to listen. There are many times during my chairmanship when the faculty wanted to do one thing and I thought it was the wrong thing to do. but I don't know an instance. And I would always, if they wanted to go a certain way on an issue, I'd go. And I don't know a single time that I made a mistake by doing that. So you don't want to ever get where you think you know how to do everything.
Are you saying the faculty was right in those issues?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, their collective judgment was better than mine. Mm-hmm. Didn't have that many instances, but I don't know a single instance where they said, turn left, I wanted to go right, and so I turned left and it worked. But you've got to show them success. You've got to win battles and let them think that, as they indeed did, help make it happen. You've got to build an esprit de corps. You want to do everything you can to build collegiality within the group. And that's something that has characterized this department now for years, and people from other universities who come as seminar speakers and so on wind up going to a dinner or a party or something at somebody's house. They've never seen a department so collegial as this one.
Yeah.
And the department is aware of that characteristic, and they're doing everything they can to foster it. Sure, you got petty jealousies, and for example, you're going to have some tension between the biological people and the analytical people, or the physical chemist. I mean, physical chemistry and analytical chemistry. At one time, when I was chairman, the national trend was to do away with analytical chemistry. We had a very strong analytical chemist by the name of Charles Riley, who was the second person after Kolthoff to get into the National Academy. Well, the physical chemists all wanted to do away with analytical, and I made it a policy to build analytical, because we saw the environmental problems on the horizon, biological, chemistry of biological systems are going to be very dependent on analytical chemistry, magnetic resonance was important, so we built analytical. And that was my biggest single battle with the faculty, where I insisted that we're going to build this. And paid off, because we got the first or second best analytical group in the country. Always consistently ranks right at the top.
What's your...
And nobody questions it today.
Yeah.
That they should get their role. Yeah.
What's your view, I'll call it the future of academic chemistry, that is, in England, departments have been closing down, here...
Forgot about that.
Here, names are changing.
Yeah.
What's your own view of that whole territory?
Well, my view of it is that what I understand is chemistry will be important for as far as we can see. And you may want to change the vocabulary a bit to make some aspects of chemistry more attractive. For example, right now in the department, the people in the biological area want to say, shouldn't we change our name to the Department of Chemistry and Biological Chemistry? Mm-hmm. And Chemistry and Biochemistry. We've got a Department of Biochemistry in the med school. But their argument is that this would help us recruit graduate students. Well, the department is resisting that effort, but I mean, that's an example of an issue related to your question. And I just think it's unnecessary, because I think as long as there are molecules, there's going to be a science of molecules. Now, what you don't want to do is get into a position that you can't see beyond the molecule. And that's where things like areas like nanotechnology, laboratory on a chip, material science. There's just many areas where you've got to go beyond your classical textbook organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry and become partially physicists or biologists or whatnot, but I think chemistry, I still believe in the concept of chemistry being the central science. I just don't think that people in biochemistry can function without chemistry. And I think it's getting harder and harder for the physicists to do their thing in many areas without chemistry. Now, sure, you can get into radiation chemistry and physics and gravitation and so on without being paying a lot of attention to molecules, but I think physics is doing more with molecules today than they ever have.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you a couple more questions about RTP?
Yeah.
Let me ask a couple about the 1990s, and between about 95 and 2000, there's the big run-up in dot-coms around the country, right? Companies being founded at the drop of a hat, looking for real estate, putting up new offices, big splashy thing all over, and a lot of them in these various university parks. So how did that play out here?
Well, we had a number of dot-coms, and some of them gone by the board, but I think you've got to be careful to distinguish between a dot-com that is simply marketing on the internet, on the one hand, because you might have called that high-tech in the 90s, but you would not today, because everybody's selling on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of those companies that were promoting advertising and sales on the internet, you might call dot-coms, they went by the board. But on the other hand, companies that are developing the technology of the internet, many of them are very successful.
So do you, and does the managing committee and the managing board, take a critical look at companies that want to move into RTP and say...
Most of the dot-coms have been startup companies.
Yeah.
But companies that have come into the park like Cisco and a more recent one, Network Appliances, they're not in trouble. I mean, their stock may fluctuate because they're still not paying dividends. And in that sense, they're like a startup, but they're big giants, and their stock is improving over time. I don't think that's what the shakeout was all about. It was more about simple applications. And if you look at my list of the companies that I know have gone out of business, and just see how many of those you would classify as a dot-com, there are not many of them.
Yeah. I guess so let me try the question a different way. What I'm trying to get at is, to what degree do you set criteria that a company has to meet, has to be sort of scientific in a certain way in order to even be here?
Yeah. there are some criteria, and I have to approach it two different ways. One is the park is zoned in two different ways, research and research applications. Research applications allows a certain kind of amount of manufacturing, but it's got to be smoke-free, noise-free, and so on. And pure research is clear enough, I think. If you're in research applications, an IBM would fit into this. You've got to have a percentage of scientific and technical personnel that exceeds the industry standard average. Now, I don't know quite how the foundation manages that, but it does not seem to have been a problem.
Has the university taken ownership shares in some of the companies that have come in?
Uh, Well, the university, in terms of managing it, their endowments, have that in the hands of professional managers, and so they don't really make those decisions. The universities.
Yeah.
Now, in another arena, your question might have been, do the universities take an ownership stake in startups based on institutional technology?
Yeah.
And there, I think, I don't know the details of that, but I think by and large they don't, although I think sometimes they do, and I think Duke is more likely to do that than a state institution is. But I don't really know the answer to that question.
What about individual faculty members? Does the chemistry department have some multimillionaires?
Oh, does the chemistry department have a multimillionaire?
Yeah. I mean, Caltech certainly has plenty.
Yeah.
And Stanford.
We have some that I think are on the way. I think Joe DeSimone is an example of one that's on the way. And Ed Zamolsky might be.
What is the regulation about what you can and can't do as a faculty member in this regard? Is it clear?
There's a policy. And I'm not current on that. I don't really know. At one time when I was in the general administration of the university system, and back when the federal government really wanted every university to have a conflict of interest policy and one that addressed some of those questions, we had a policy. And I've forgotten how it was worded. I really lost touch with it.
But is it translating into some version of a sort of one day in seven in terms of how...
Oh, now you're asking another question now.
Yeah.
You're talking about conflict of time, the conflict of effort, not interest. There's a generally understood policy that I'm not sure is written down anywhere that a day a week for consulting is okay, and that is very important in schools of business, for example, but it would also apply to how much time Joe DeSimone might spend with his companies. A day a week is still unwritten policy, but I'm not sure.
Yes. Look at Research Triangle Park today.
Yeah.
Talk for a minute about its success and challenges that you see on the agenda looking forward now. Financing RTP is not a challenge. It's not a challenge, I don't think. What are the challenges?
Well, our big challenge right now is, what are we going to be when they grow up? We have sold all but 10% of the land. And over time, the foundation has played a very important role vis-a-vis the tenants. One thing, for example, which started long, long time ago is that we have been responsible for mowing the grass on the roads through the park, because if it was left up to the state, they'd get mowed twice a year and the park wouldn't look like much. Ultimately, we're going to work that off on the tenants, and I'll talk about how we'll do that in a few minutes. Whenever there's a problem, and just one illustration is that IBM and some other companies were having real trouble with their computers going down because squirrels were jumping off the trees onto the power lines and shorting them out, and the computers would crash. So they bring that problem to the foundation, and so the foundation gets with the power companies, and we decide to increase the easements, and the power companies cut the trees a little bit further back. And we solve that kind of problem, which for everybody. At one time, the park is not in any municipality, and at one time Durham wanted to annex it. So the foundation fought that annexation successfully.
This is the foundation as a sort of city manager, essentially.
Exactly. There's an owners and tenants association that can bring these problems to the foundation. But they can also do something else under some state legislation. They can vote to ask the two counties to increase the ad valorem taxes by up to a certain amount. And then the owners and tenants can spend that money, and they get the foundation to carry it out. You might be building jogging trails, beautification, improving the signage, building athletic fields, this sort of thing. So we are a city manager of a community that cannot be annexed but can tax itself. And the clever thing about taxing itself is that if you ask every company to contribute, they couldn't all do it. But they can all pay taxes.
Yes, yeah. And that those realities are something that's evolved or being put in place over time. This wasn't in any way part of an initial concept.
Well, yes, but this business of non-annexation and ad valorem taxation all came in a single act of the General Assembly when Durham tried to annex the park. So a lot of it came from that. But the park, the foundation had already been providing these services and been representing. So the question before us now, there are two major questions before the foundation. One of them is, what is going to be our role when all the land is sold? Because we still have obligations, and should have, to these companies. And for the general benefit of the area and the state, we should be doing this. As long as we can make this a very special place, it's going to take an input from us of some sort. So what are we going to be doing? Well, there are several things. Another thing, it will be entering a phase of rehabilitation within the park. For example, the IBM original buildings were built in 65. Well, they're pretty obsolete buildings now. They don't belong to us. But if any company wants to sell its property, the foundation has the right of first refusal.
Okay.
So are we going to be buying properties and renovating them? Are we going to be finding ways to work with companies to renovate buildings that need it? And what would be our role in that? I mean, these are questions we haven't answered yet, but they're the things we're talking about. What can we do now to encourage the economic development of other areas of the state?
I was going to say, are other parks in the cards?
There's a very successful park in Charlotte. If you look at the top dozen research parks in the country in terms of employment, Charlotte's in there.
But is it in the cards that the RTP Foundation might set up another park?
Oh. We looked into that 5 years ago. First, we looked at land that was immediately contiguous to the park. All that land costs two or three times what we sell our land for. Mm-hmm. Partly because zoning in the park, a company can only build on 15% of its holdings, where outside the park you can build 60 or 80%. So that's more valuable. We can't buy it. We looked at some land that Carolina Power and Light owns about 20 miles from the park around a nuclear station that is a buffer area. And could we joint venture with this power company in developing some of that property? That broke down for tax reasons. So any land in the near vicinity of the park is out of the question. Now, our charter does say that we're created for the purpose of promoting industrial and governmental research labs in the area defined as a research triangle around these three institutions, or in any other part of the state.
Okay. Smart.
So we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
But thus far, we have felt that it is better for Charlotte to develop its own research park under its own local control with any assistance we can give them. And we sent most of their early tenants to them because they didn't fit our criteria. The Charlotte Park is not really a research park. It's a high-tech service park. I mean, they've got a lot of things like the building services for Sears Roebuck. Sears, no longer Sears Roebuck, is it? Sears. Some life insurance companies and this sort of thing. Not a great deal of real research. Kodak has a magnetic disc manufacturing facility there, and IBM has some that they got came there because of coming to our park. Our staff is visiting places like Winston-Salem, which has a park in Prospect, particularly built around the Wake Forest Medical School, which is doing some very fine work, particularly on growing replacement organs, where they're having some successes growing new bladders and this sort of thing for people. I had my bladder removed earlier this summer. I may have mentioned that to you. And I asked my surgeon, can't you save a little piece on that? Maybe we can take it up to Wake Forest and grow me a new one. And he said, no. He said, that technology is not yet proven enough to warrant that. But anyhow, they're making great strides. And we're trying to help them every way we can to develop a research park. East Carolina University down in Greenville is wanting to do the same thing. And we've been down there, or our staff has, to help them think through some of their problems. So at the moment, most of what we're doing for the state, aside from having some of our companies build production facilities, which there's more of that than there is, but there is some, or some of our spinoffs locating elsewhere in the state. We think that maybe we can encourage more of our spinoffs to locate their manufacturing elsewhere in the state. That's an angle we're going to push.
Has the Research Triangle Foundation grown rich with the success of the park?
Yes and no. Yes, but we have plowed a lot of money into the universities on this strip of land which we'll visit Monday. We've put some $40 or $50 million into joint programs of the three universities.
Okay. That takes me to the territory that says is when you look at the inter-university relationship and the university industry relationship, what's the balance sheet of success and failure and joy and sorrow? And
well, I don't remember the numbers, but when the foundation celebrated its 40th anniversary, I took on a project of measuring research dollar flow in both directions, from the universities to park organizations, park to the universities, subcontracting. I looked at the exchange of people, adjunct appointments of park personnel, joint appointments of people from the universities in research, hiring exchanges. I mean, at one time, NC State University had 5 deans that they recruited out of the park over time without any acrimony or anything. But anyhow, I had some figures on that, and they were pretty impressive, but they are almost 10 years old, and I don't remember them.
So your impressionistic report is...
Yeah, it's a great deal. But I think that the single greatest effect, this is my judgment, of the Research Triangle on the universities is that it has created a can-do attitude on the universities, that, and by can do, I mean we can really move to the top ranks. We've got an area that is scientifically and engineeringly impacted, attractive place to live. We can recruit the best faculty in the country. We can compete with each other and still be friends. And I think that the universities, all three of them, have achieved standing that they never could have achieved without the Research Triangle. And I think that's the single most important thing that's happened. Hiring faculty, the best faculty, is easy. Where when I was chairman, and before the park was deemed a success, you know, it was tough.
Yeah.
Of course, in those days, it was the old boy network. And I'd call up George Hammond and I'd say, George, we've got an opening for an organic chemist and I'd like to have your best graduate student apply for it. And I'll never forget what he said. He said, well, Bill, my best graduate student I will not recommend to you because I don't think he would live in the South. But I would recommend my second best graduate student, David Whitten. And I wound up hiring David Whitten. And David Whitten wound up outstripping the number one by far. But still, you see, that was a reaction I got.
Yes, yes.
Early on, in 1965, that fired me up to really push this notion of the Research Triangle. When an organization comes to the park, the foundation often invites the CEO to come to one of our board meetings and tell us in 15 minutes, you know, what you're up to, meet us, and so on, the board, and they'll always respond. One company came and they said, you know, he said, you know, last week I was in Germany talking to my counterpart, and I told him that next week we're going to be opening our new facility in North Carolina. And the German says, Jawohl, we know about North Carolina. It's in the Research Triangle Park. That illustrates what I'm saying.
Yeah, that might be a great place to stop. We congratulate you on that achievement.
Yeah.
Well, I hope I haven't been overly tooting my own horn, but
not at all.
No, not at all. This felt like it went really well, actually.
I hope have we covered them.
What did we? One of the things I always ask at the end is, what did we forget to ask you?
I'm just scanning your list here for a moment. See if there's anything that prompts me to comment. I think probably we've done a good job of covering things. And the only thing that I would say beyond what's already been said is that I sometimes feel I've, between the university and the Research Triangle, I've lived in parallel universes that occasionally intersect.
but probably that has its charm, actually.
Yeah, yeah. No, I don't regret anything about my... Oh, I've got to tell you one more anecdote. Triangle University Center for Advanced Studies Incorporated, which you'll see Monday. Acronym is TUCASI. Alcorn. We had our first meeting after incorporation about a week before the National Humanities Center was going to announce their decision to come here. Their announcement being at the Algonquin Hotel in New York City. We had a press release. I worked with the three news bureaus to develop one, and we used the acronym TUCAS, Triangle University Center for Advanced Studies. And Felix Joyner, who is the vice president for finance of the university system, said, how do you pronounce that? Well, TUCAS. Get it? And he said, oh my God, what are we going to do? We'll look like fools in New York City. And John Caldwell, who was chancellor of NC State University, says, wait a minute, we're incorporated. So put an I on there and it becomes Tukasi.
Yes. Yes.
It's got a nice lilt to it. So I took this press release and pinned in an I everywhere we had the acronym. The Governor's Inn didn't have a copy machine in those days. This was 1975. So I ran across the parking lot to a copy center and had a bunch of those made. And then when we walked out to the press conference, the luncheon and press conference, television sets and everything, casually handed out these press releases and nobody raised a question.
Just as well. Very good. Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Pleasure.